I am Plant on the Line. This is the commentary.ca. Joining me now is Dr. Joe Schwartz. He's the director of the McGill University's Office for Science and Society. He hosts a weekly program on CFRB in Toronto and writes a weekly column in the Montreal Gazette. He's on today to discuss his new book, Brain Fuel, 199 Mind-Expanding Inquiries into the Science of Everyday Life. It's an interesting look at science in our lives through facts and anecdotes like why a daily dose of chocolate is good for you, or how safety glass was discovered. You'll also find out why Alfred Hitchcock was afraid of eggs and why it matters. Brain Fuel is published by Doubleday and retails for $24. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Dr. Joe Schwartz. Good morning, Dr. Schwartz.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
What is your job at McGill?
Well, my office is rather unique because its mandate is to demystify science for the public, to make sure that people are up to date on current research and science as it applies to them. We try to separate sense from nonsense, foster critical thinking, and with all of that, we hope to keep people out of the clutches of the charlatans. And it really is the first time that any major university anywhere has said that our job is not over the moment that our students leave our gates, because there's such hunger today for scientific information among the general public that if we don't give them a focal place where they can address their questions, they will end up listening to whoever is standing on the tallest soapbox screaming the loudest. And those usually are not the most trustworthy people. So our office is dedicated to demystifying science, and we do this in all kinds of ways, email, phone calls, public lectures. I do it on the radio, TV, my newspaper articles, and, of course, with my books.
And these people, these charlatans that you refer to, who are they?
Well, charlatans are people who claim to have knowledge that they don't actually have. In many cases, it is the people who market various kinds of dietary supplements and snake oil products, which they claim will cure virtually every disease known to mankind, for which there is really no scientific evidence. And these days, with the aid of the web, unfortunately, this is prolific. There are all kinds of people who market esoteric juices from fruits, claiming that this is the answer to all of life's problems, to ridiculous foot baths where people sit with their feet in the water, see the color change in the water, and are told that that's toxins being removed from their body, which is just scientific absurdity. So there never is a shortage of quackery to deal with.
In the book, you discuss Hitchcock and his aversion to eggs.
I do. Now, the reason for that is frankly, just to get the curiosity going, because most people have heard of Hitchcock. At least they remember the movie The Birds, and they probably think that it's some connection to bird eggs, why he feared eggs. No, he just hated the texture and the sight of eggs. And it wasn't because he was worried about cholesterol and health. And if you remember what Alfred looked like, you know, he wasn't very worried about his diet.
Right.
But the reason that I pose the question in that way is because it then allows me to get into the question of whether or not eggs really are dangerous and should we really worry about them. And the answer to that is no. The egg yolk does contain cholesterol, but cholesterol is not responsible for driving up our blood cholesterol nearly as much as the fats in the diet, the so-called saturated fats. And there is really no evidence that eating 5 to 7 eggs a week has any impact on blood cholesterol levels, except in some very rare cases where people have extreme cholesterol sensitivity, but that's extremely, extremely unusual. So I use the Hitchcock hook in order to get people interested so that we can talk about the serious nature of cholesterol.
So you're saying that eating 5 to 7 eggs a week is not dangerous?
Right.
Who's been saying that it is?
Are
the people that market those egg substitutes and things like that, are they responsible
for
that?
Well, I mean, there's all false information coming from all kinds of places. But generally, it's just people coming to the wrong conclusion based on what they've read. There's no question that cholesterol in the blood is linked to heart disease. There's no question that cholesterol is found in egg yolk. And then people make the leap that therefore egg yolks are dangerous in terms of heart disease. But one has to look at numbers and take a look to see, does the cholesterol in the egg yolk really translate into increasing blood cholesterol levels? And the answer to that is that the effect really is minimal. And this is why, you know, I keep saying that information is so important and interpretation of information is so important, because it prevents people from worrying about things that probably they should not be worried about.
I was reading an article that Dan Gardner wrote in the Ottawa Citizen, and he's been on the program before. He had that book on risk, and he'd written about pesticides, and and you were interviewed for that piece.
Right.
And that's the same message that you're saying, that the amount
matters. Numbers matter. Science is based not only on qualitative measurements, but quantitative as well. And it doesn't make any sense to talk about a substance being toxic or not without putting it into proper context. Is aspirin toxic? Well, it all depends on how you look at it. Aspirin is very effective for headaches, but how much? If you take an aspirin tablet and you lick it, well, that's not going to do very much for your headache. If you take two tablets and swallow them, your headache will resolve. If you take a whole bottle of tablets, well, you will kind of dissolve away, right? The dose is in the toxicity is in the dose and in the context. And it's very important to paint the proper picture. People are worried about pesticide residues. Well, there are some concerns about pesticides, mostly in the case of the people who are using them, who are applying them. They have to take proper care. But the amount of residues that are present are really very, very small. And anybody who gives up eating fruits and vegetables because they're worried about pesticide residues is actually doing themselves a disfavor, because we know so much about the benefits of fruits and vegetables. So, you know, eschewing them because of the hypothetical link between pesticides and disease is not the way to go.
But Dr. Joe, what about just erring on the side of caution?
Well, we do that. We do err on the side of caution. This is what regulatory authorities do. In Canada, for example, the Pest Management Regulatory Agency, I think, does an excellent job of erring on the side of caution in a reasonable way. How do we do that? Well, when we take a look at the potential risk of pesticides, we do animal studies. And you take a look at the maximum amount of a substance that causes no effect in an animal. That's called the no observed adverse effect level. And then you divide that by a factor of 100 before you come to a number that you say is the acceptable daily intake. So it has a 100-fold safety factor built in there in terms of the dose that doesn't cause any problems in test animals. So I would suggest that that really is erring on the side of caution. But you can't completely eliminate risk. I know it is very inviting to use this expression, the precautionary principle, and to eliminate all risk unless you have complete proof of safety. But that's kind of a naive expectation, because you can never prove that something is completely safe. You can never prove a negative. You can't prove that something cannot happen. So we all are always left to make decisions based on risk-benefit ratios.
Now, chocolate. You say in the book that a daily dose of chocolate will do us good. Does it matter what sort of chocolate?
It sure does. First of all, we can dismiss white chocolate from this equation, because white chocolate isn't really chocolate. White chocolate is a blend of cocoa butter and sugar, basically. Now, that doesn't say it doesn't taste good, but it has no redeeming nutritional value. On the other hand, the dark chocolate does, because it contains compounds called polyphenols. And polyphenols are very interesting in their molecular action. They're called antioxidants, which means that they have the ability of neutralizing those rogue molecular species we call free radicals. And those are a byproduct of life. Every time we breathe oxygen, we produce some free radicals. But at the same time, as we need the oxygen to live, the free radical friendly fire, as it were, is also aging us and can also precipitate disease. But antioxidants can neutralize many of these free radicals. And the polyphenols found in chocolate do exactly that. And clinical studies have shown that it can reduce cholesterol levels in the blood and also reduce high blood pressure. How much? Well, talking about 50, 70 grams a day. So we're not talking, obviously, about complete license to eat as much chocolate as anyone desires. What we're really saying is once you've had your supper and you're looking for dessert, it makes a lot more sense to have a few squares of dark chocolate than to have that giant slab of Black Forest cake.
That's the one thing that's interesting about this book. It's not just facts, and it's not just sort of trivia. You sort of give us a better understanding.
Yes, it certainly is not trivia. The 199 questions I've specially selected in various ways, some because these are the kind of questions that I've been asked on my radio show, questions that I'm asked after public lectures, and some are questions that I think are just things that people should know the answers to. But my theme in the whole book has been to design the questions themselves to pique curiosity, to say, oh, just an interesting question. I never even thought of that question. And then you answer the question, and that opens the door into a discussion of more fundamental science and more everyday science. So it's a bit like teasing them with a bit of sugar before you make the medicine go down.
And how did you write the book?
The book kind of evolved. This is not the kind of book that you sit down and write from morning to night, because the questions come up in different ways. I mean, sometimes it was from my own personal experience. For example, I'd gone to see the musical Chicago, in which there's a song about a material that is translucent and you can't see it. And for the reference, it's the cellophane. So I thought, gee, this is a very good way to get into the topic of packaging materials and what cellophane is. So I asked that kind of question. And then I remembered a TV show, MacGyver, where he plugged up a hole in a leaking sulfuric acid tank with a chocolate bar. MacGyver was kind of a scientific hero who was sort of a general crime fighter, but instead of using guns, he used his mind and scientific knowledge. So I used that. I remember going to a movie, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and wondering, gee, that river of chocolate, surely it couldn't have been real chocolate. They would never do that. So how do they do that chemically? So I did a little bit of research, and it turns out to be carboxymethylcellulose, which is a recognized food additive. It's a thickening agent, and that's how they did that. And then, of course, I get asked questions about the health benefits of oats and barley. And so those kind of things make it into the book, and why asparagus that is cooked in oil tastes better than asparagus that is cooked in water. And that's because the flavor compounds dissolve in water and they would be leached out. But if you cook it in oil, then the flavor compounds stay put. And about what is the best way to cook broccoli? Well, it's with a small amount of water in the microwave oven is the answer. There was a study that a lot of people were worried about, where Spanish researchers showed that cooking broccoli in a microwave oven leaches out nutrients. Well, people didn't look at the details, and the detail was that those Spanish researchers had no idea how to properly use a microwave oven. They immersed the broccoli completely in water and cooked it for a long time, and that's not the way that you would normally do it. So, the questions come from all over the place.
There's an interesting thing in the book about gas station attendants. When they leave work, they have a higher rate of accidents.
This observation arose in Taiwan. And it is because there they still have gas station attendants who actually fill up your tank and inhale some of the gasoline vapors. And these can affect your mind. They can make you high. So after working all day besides the gas pumps, they would have a significant amount of gasoline in their bodies. And when they drove home, their reaction time was not up to par. Of course, when they came to work in the morning, they were not loaded up with gasoline. So what this really triggered was some technology in order to introduce systems into the gas pump that would prevent the vapor from escaping and capture it, which of course also has economic consequences because you're not losing the gasoline.
There's a link between diabetes and eating fish. This goes back to our initial points that we were talking about earlier about there is mercury in fish. Is that correct?
That is correct. There's mercury in fish, and mercury is certainly a potential toxin. Again, it depends on which kind of mercury. Elemental mercury or liquid mercury is not as much a problem as methyl mercury, which is a form of mercury that is dissolved in water. And it gets into the air, essentially, from burning coal. Coal is always contaminated with small amounts of mercury. Then rainwater brings it down into natural water systems where bacteria convert the elemental mercury to methyl mercury, and it gets absorbed by fish. We eat the fish, and therefore we get mercury into our body. Now, mercury is a neurotoxin, so we certainly have to be concerned about that. And recent evidence shows that it can interfere with the functioning of the pancreas and insulin release, so there's a possible diabetes connection. So the question, of course, comes up, do we eat fish or do we not? Well, the answer is not a yes or no. Very seldom is the question to assign is the answer to a scientific question yes or no. It depends on which kind of fish and for whom. If someone is pregnant, then you want to be extra careful about the amount of mercury to ingest, and you stay away from shark, you stay away from swordfish, you stay away from large tuna, but it's perfectly fine to eat salmon because that has a very low mercury level. But if you're not a pregnant woman, then the story is different, because then the amount of mercury is far, far less relevant, and the benefits of eating fish completely outweigh the detriment of the small amount of mercury, because fish contains fats called omega-3 fats, which we know can reduce the risk of irregular heartbeats. We know that the brain needs omega-3 fats. The cell membranes are made of omega-3 fats. They make our brain work better. Indeed, studies have shown that women who eat fish during pregnancy give birth to babies that have higher IQs. So again, one has to delve into the problem in somewhat greater depth than just scratch the surface in order to come up with reasonable answers.
Sean Penn has just, I think the movie's already out now, it's played in film festivals. He plays Harvey Milk, and you write about him in the book with regards to the person that killed him. Mm-hmm. Who claimed that he killed Milk because he was addicted to Twinkies.
Right.
Can one be addicted to junk food?
Well, it depends on how you define addiction. I don't think you can be physically addicted. Physical addiction means that you show withdrawal symptoms of it, withdrawn, and also that you show tolerance, meaning that you need more and more in order to get the same effect. But I think you can be addicted to the taste. Like it so much that you would eat it in preference to other things like fruits and vegetables. I think that can happen. And the Twinkie story is a very interesting one because of the legal case that enveloped it, where the accused murderer claimed that Twinkies made him do it, that it was a junk food diet that resulted in his aberrant action. And there really is no evidence for that kind of function of these foods. I'm certainly not a big proponent of Twinkies as a nutritious food, but they don't make people murder others.
And finally, Dr. Joe, does an apple a day really keep the doctor away?
Only if you throw it at him or her. but it is, I think it's a very good metaphor for eating more fruits and vegetables.
This is really a fun book, and we could talk all day about it. There's just so much in there. Congratulations on writing it, and continued good luck with it.
Well, thank you very much.
The book is called Brain Fuel, 199 Mind-Expanding Inquiries into the Science of Everyday Life, $24 from Doubleday for the commentary. I'm Joseph Planta.